Campus FM presents a talk organized by the Department of Youth and Community Studies entitled Inclusive Education at the Crossroads. This talk was delivered by Professor Roger Slee from the University of London and chaired by Dr. Andrew Azzopardi.
Dear colleagues, allow me to introduce today's public seminar, Inclusive Education at the Crossroads. The main speaker is Professor Roger Slee from the prestigious University of London, and he is part of the Institute of Education. Professor Slee has an extensive CV. He has occupied posts in academia as dean, amongst other roles, held administrative posts in administration, worked in Canada, worked in Australia, working in England. And he has written, as I said, extensively with very important contributors in the field of disability inclusion and inclusive education. People like Len Barton, people like Professor Mike Oliver, Jenny Morris, and the list goes on and on. So, however, before asking Professor Slee to give his contribution, I would like to invite the student representatives of our Masters in Inclusive Education and Communities cohorts, Carmel Bezzina and Amanda Muscat, who together with their colleagues prepared a presentation to start us off. I think a very provocative presentation awaits us. It's called Inclusion Over they'll give us more details on that. English is my second language. So after that, I will be presenting briefly, and then we can move on to Professor Roger Slee. So now I leave it up to Amanda and Carmel to get on with their presentation.
I hope that you will find this seminar fruitful, and I welcome Professor Roger Slee, Dr. Andrew Azzopardi, and each and every one of you to this part of our presentation, where Amanda and myself, Carmel, who are, as Andrew said, the student representatives of the Masters in Inclusive Education and Communities, where we will deliver, obviously, a presentation on inclusion. We named this presentation Inclusion Our Conundrum, because many a times in this master's course we have debated and raised issues and questions which made us think and reflect on the different facets of this subject. To give you a brief outline of our masters we are studying, it is being run for the first time at the University of Malta. Reading these masters are various professionals coming from health, educational and social sectors. They are over there. Mainly occupational therapists, speech and language pathologists, teachers, social workers and learning support assistants. This divergence in the professions promotes the notion of transdisciplinary teamwork, where we are having the opportunity to study together. This is making us aware of the different realities of the persons we work with and of our professional experiences. We are hoping that this short presentation will raise interesting issues about inclusion, which will make you think and rethink about what actions can be considered inclusive and what not. The classroom is the first setting many people think of when hearing the word inclusion. And indeed, it is one of the most important places where it must be implemented. Classrooms are for children who are still young, but who will grow and participate in society and influence it with their actions. Thus, it makes a lot of sense to make sure that all classrooms are inclusive, where every student would feel a sense of belonging, and where every student's needs and where every student's needs are recognized and addressed. Thus, even though people pass through similar experiences and there are a lot of similarities amongst people, every human being is unique and irreplaceable. Inclusion calls for a change in attitude. By simply placing a child with a disability in a classroom of able-bodied students, that is not inclusion, but merely integration. In inclusive classrooms, students realize that everyone has the potential to give and receive, thus actively participate in a learning environment where creativity and diversity are celebrated and encouraged. In inclusive classrooms, it does not matter whether students are able-bodied or have disabilities, as everyone would have the chance to achieve his or her potentials, and barriers are eliminated through love and respect. One can either be for or against inclusion. If educators do not realize that they must work to make classrooms more inclusive, then the classrooms are bound to become hostile and segregating. Inclusion requires careful planning and implementation of programs which celebrate everyone's abilities, programs which value altruism and brotherhood rather than competition and individualism. When shifting the concept of inclusion into the outside community, the situation becomes more complex. Schools are still contained, where the population is restricted to students, staff, and parents, but the outside community is another story, where the space is bigger and the stakeholders are numerous. It is not surprising that parents of children with disability worry about their children's future, especially when the parents themselves would pass away. In fact, the parents would put their minds at rest if they would be assured that someone will take care of their children. Is the outside community unsafe enough to make disabled persons fear to go into it? And what community is inclusive enough? The local, national, global community? Can the outside community become less hostile and more inclusive in such a way that disabled persons would start showing the willingness to participate in society and their parents would not worry about it? Speaking of parents, professionals at times feel that parents offer the most difficult hurdles to let them work with the children to become more included in the community. How does society perceive disabled persons? What comes to mind when we hear the word disability? Care, assistance, assessments, diagnosis, treatment, therapy are much central to the world of disabled persons as society perceives it. What are the implications of this picture? Disability activists have promoted with all their might the idea of independence in the sense of control, the chance to decide about one's lives without having persons who call themselves professionals deciding what is best for persons with disability. What does it really mean to give persons with disability their dignity? If we are working with a person with a disability and the goals we have set are not met, who do we blame? Can we really assess the risk that disabled persons take to participate in society? And can we really measure the pressure they feel because many people would be staring and looking at them in annoying and disrespectful ways, and this for doing just a simple thing like going for a walk? When speaking about the outside community, one cannot refrain from speaking about work. The significance that society gives to work is tremendous. Work gives us money, status, power, opportunities to meet people, meaning to our lives, possibilities to pursue our dreams, and a lot more. Thus, when disabled persons would be excluded from the world of work, they would be refrained from having a lot more than just money and something to do. And when thinking about inclusion, one has to think about those who are most oppressed and discriminated. In the world of work, one would look at persons with intellectual disabilities, who, if perceived as incapable and childish, would be more likely to attend a day center or stay at home with their relatives rather than given the chance to work and meaningfully participate and contribute within society. When thinking about inclusion, it is worthwhile for us professionals who work with oppressed persons to ask ourselves what our role is and what our aim should be. To have disability activists criticize professionals for creating a disability industry where mainly the interests of professionals are safeguarded is something which must make us think and reflect. What are we doing here? Whose interests are we safeguarding? What does it really mean to take the voices of disabled persons seriously? Who are the experts in inclusion? Who shall take decisions? This also applies to the research arena, where disabled persons are easily seen as subjects which help professionals get their qualifications. And what about those who genuinely oppose our views of inclusion? Is inclusion meant for all? What if students does not want to join the others and prefer to stay alone? Is inclusion what all students want or need? Are we treating people as equals or the same? Are we being dangerously naive in simplifying problems? Are we measuring the qualities of life of persons with disabilities and their families?
An everlasting debate is whether it is best to push towards special education in segregated settings or whether we should go for the inclusive settings by closing down special schools and having mainstream schools as the only option for the parents who have children with disabilities. We must admit, though, that at times it is hard to convince ourselves that inclusive settings is the only viable option. Is it time to call for a new direction in special education and inclusion? Should we opt for either one or the other, or start thinking in terms of another alternative to regular and special school placements, one that focuses on a better nature of schooling? It is commonly agreed amongst educators that effective instruction with students with disability is best practiced in a systematic way, explicitly as well as intensively. And the question here comes naturally. Is this what truly happens in mainstream settings? Also, are we saying that place is the critical element in defining special education? This sets a challenge after the other, starting with what needs to be taught, at what level of intensity, with what materials and strategies, at what pace, and so forth. Now, with regards to curriculum or syllabus, as it is called in the Maltese context, to what extent is it marginalizing students during their schooling? Shifting our attention to the schooling experience, can we really blame some parents to still favor segregated settings? Is the mainstream setting fully supportive of each of the students' range of abilities and needs? If the answer to this is not yet, then is it fair to rule out any other option whereby a student with disability can receive his or her education? It is therefore imperative to fully consider what the covert messages of educators and administrators are when working with parents and students with disabilities. Is the attempt at inclusion being carried out genuinely, or is it a student with disability in school being perceived as a problem that is being added to our agenda? Another arguable issue is the chance of overlooking medical conditions and impairments of students with disability. And if not tackled seriously, this might concern parents who have children with disability. The policy that is being implemented in schools is that of inclusion, but could it be possibly causing impotence and helplessness in practice? What happens when students with behavioral, social, emotional difficulties find themselves in inclusive settings? Is the educational package flexible enough to allow space for their education, social, and emotional needs? Are we being unrealistic in thinking that once these youngsters are in an inclusive setting, the behavior or emotional problems are simply going to be fixed? How is differentiation in maintaining discipline carried out in a school where some of the students have these behavioral, emotional, and social difficulties? It is known that traditional discipline methods are ineffective with these youngsters. So to what extent are these youngsters being adequately served in a system where schools are too large and classes are too big? Again, the tone and content of the curriculum is again a factor which needs to be considered seriously. Does the academic curriculum reflect the students' interests or value system? Does it give them enough flexibility or the opportunity to work on behavior, self-esteem, and personal and health and social education? As we all know, we need a collective effort to have a really inclusive community, and especially in education, educators are the key persons. Are educators, and here I'm referring to both experienced and trainees, being provided with sufficient information about the background of students and their emotional state? Are experienced teachers being properly guided on their changing role, or are they literally just thrown into deep end and expected to cope? At this point, we must question whether we can really have inclusive classrooms in a system which is more exclusionary rather than inclusive, especially when teachers feel suffocated with the vast syllabus that is leaving insufficient time for community building in the classrooms. Another interesting facet of inclusion, which is often disregarded, is the presence of students who perform at the other end of the ability spectrum. Are the talented and the gifted being discriminated when they are expected to stick to the syllabus, whereas they'd rather be introduced to new material in order to widen their horizons even more? A core issue that is touching us on a personal level, most of us actually students following this course, is the therapist's role in inclusive settings such as the mainstream schools. Parents and students feel and express the need of receiving intervention offered by healthcare professionals. Since appropriate suggestions and adaptation may assist students to be more included within their school and community, therapists are facing a dilemma. Shall students continue receiving therapy in clinics? How are we to weigh the benefits of therapy despite excluding these students from their school settings and peers? On the same lines, is the presence of a learning support assistant causing exclusion of the students from participation and engaging with peers? All these support systems help students to make success in life possible. Unfortunately, entities tend to work separately on these issues, concerning well-being and improved quality of life of these students with disability and their family. So isn't it time to communicate and try to bridge the gaps between the different sectors, such as the education, health, social services, employment agency, to really ensure that everyone succeeds? Some final considerations go to assessing and the role of examination in the inclusive education practice. And here we may question, what are equitable assessing methods that can be used for students with disabilities in inclusive settings? What is the degree of fairness towards the rest of the students when a student is given help and extra concessions in exams? Shall we opt for continuous assessment or uphold the current examination system? Ultimately, what is the use of exams? To stream students? Isn't streaming a contradiction of inclusion? Now, on a final note, our cohort is continuously challenging the quest of understanding inclusion. Now is particularly a good time for everyone to reflect on the philosophy of inclusion and why inclusion is so popular in the first place. Perhaps these philosophies are still worthwhile and we are committed to look at ways to make inclusion work, keeping always in mind the student's strengths and need. But we commonly strongly believe that even though we might never reach the ideal and the romantic idea of inclusive communities, however, we can get nearer and nearer through teaming up. And this is our dictum, which we would like to share with you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'd like to go through my presentation now, which I called Inclusive Education or Inconclusive Education. There are two important annotations that I would like to make straight away. First, inclusive education is turning out to be a cliché, a politically correct term that is used for speeches and for policymakers to silence all woes. Secondly, inclusion is an encompassing term. This word is full to capacity with arguments, disputes, and contestations. But what is inclusion fundamentally? Is inclusion an end in itself, or is it a process that starts in school but has to find its fulfillment in adult life? What audit processes do we need to engage in to have a positive inclusion? Using the term inconclusive education as opposed to inclusive education is no wisecrack. The debate on inclusion is an ongoing, undying process. This in itself can have its positives, but it is also a situation which brings to my mind circumstances whereby inclusion has a preface but no end to it. It very often turns out to be a philosophical debate rather than a strategic framework. Inclusion is about positioning the special school debate. I feel that in the local context, we may still look down on special schools and on the virtuous work that they have been responsible for in the past. This is not right. We need to look at educational processes as all chipping into the weaving of this educational fabric. However, special schooling, in my estimation, is diametrically opposed to having an inclusion strategy that teaches in remoteness rather than enclosure, in privacy rather than attachment. Children learn when they are together, encapsulated in the same experiences, interacting together. Having said all this, what are the arguments that will help us iron these folds? These are some fundamental questions we need to ask in the inclusion debate. In what way can the stories of children at the margins expose issues of inclusion and exclusion? What are the different perspectives of parent and disabled activists, teachers, academics, labeled students, paraprofessionals, and others in relation to presenting a transformative agenda for inclusion. Are we pinning our ears back to parental expertise? It is necessary to create an inclusion movement. This is no longer an isolated issue that interests the few. It is a debate that has a great deal of social and economic implications for the island. Inclusive education can be analyzed within a number of varied frameworks, the cultural, historical, political, social. However, inclusion is fundamentally an elaborate interaction that is taking place within the social structures we are engaged in. We need to interpret this combination of issues and decipher emerging problems contained in this complex intermix of inclusion discourses. Where to from here? We need to assess in what way the narratives of students expose matters of inclusion and exclusion. We need to ask, what are the practices that infuse inclusion, and what is the position of various roles within the school community? We have to read the inclusion economy. Where is our money and resources going? We need to set up a national forum that will converge all the forces implicated in the dispute. NGOs, university, government services, commissioner of children, welfare services, self-advocacy groups. We need to redress the curriculum. The way we are designing our programs of study only give more reason to exclusion. Inclusion needs to be fostered and nourished by a healthy political debate. School communities are there to include the facility of speaking up for one's own right, designing options based on informed choices, having the facility to listen to and be taken seriously, developing new skills, helping, supporting, representing, and getting adequate information. School community will not just happen. Our society is still very selective, secretive, reticent. The way that schools are structured reflect the culture and experience of a community, and the curriculum is to take account of this reality, rather than just accounting for a traditional chase for credentials. A school institution can bring about an ideological intent of oppressing students in already oppressed contexts. Inclusive education is by no stretch of the imagination, a problem-free experience, even within the best possible scenario. Rather than seeking to fix people and to separate them from mainstream society, we need to address the complex issues that will enhance society. The solution, therefore, lies not in the person as an individual, but within society. It is in deconstructing barriers that people will be able to read into a community that is inclusive. Inclusion policy is about treating the students equally and not the same. I have come to depict a reality where there is a need for students with a disability to be included rather than in existing in educational institutions that segregate and exclude them. Stories of children with disability emerge the barriers of friendship. Friendship is the biggest gap there is with their non-disabled peers. Any inclusion policy and strategy will be a letdown if the issue of assimilating disabled and non-disabled children does not happen. Inclusion, even in Malta, is a contemporary debate in education that raises a great deal of discussion and argumentation, but regrettably remains a dispassionate topic with shallow exchanges. Policymakers, politicians, parents and disabled activists are at opposing polarities. On the one hand, policymakers and politicians petition for a different type of learning, the removal of 11-plus exams and the eradication of streaming. On the other hand, all provisions and structures favor exclusion. Education in Malta in recent history has attempted to focus on standards. This current has seeped through most state, private and independent private schools. Fundamentally, inclusion addresses a search for inducing equality and individualized programs suited to the particular needs of students. Assessment, appraisal, and evaluative systems embody the standard-based movement in schools. Such a lobby contributes to this polarization. Contested practices persist in all schools, and students and their parents continue to be affected, sometimes profoundly, by the interpretation of the educational needs of academics and bureaucrats. The discourse of inclusive education has its own particular characteristics. and has been hijacked by concerns for quality and achievement. Education reflects the struggle of a community of citizens. Inclusion is one vital factor that brings this conflict at the forefront, based on the principle of social integrity. The essence of inclusive education is the ability to respond to diversity. It is a process whereby children are given a voice. The National Minimum Curriculum and other reforms at state level have been responsible for the restructuring in the educational system conditioned by a competitive stance. Inclusion needs to find its position primarily within this trajectory. Children labeled as having special needs rarely get to know the children in their neighborhood because the school experience is still not conducive enough to embrace such a diversity. The real cure for educational troubles is the rightful interpretation of community goals. Inclusion cannot remain a neutral and an apolitical discourse. It is an event relating to a social experience. Among the various factors that contribute to an inclusive school are the roles that each member in the school community plays. Role distinction is imperative in establishing a considerate and responsive community. A vibrant school community is one that is constantly on the move, where the deep-seated goal is to reach out to all students, empowering them with the necessary skills they will need for their future. Students fundamentally need to be able to work in a diverse community which is respectful of difference. A real-world experience which draws from the communal context they come from is the most natural, effective, and long-lasting way for children to learn. It is essential that inclusive education is not turned into another bureaucratic discourse. Inclusive education is really a process of people inquiring into their own context to see how it can be developed. It is a process of growth. It is a social process, and it engages people in making sense of their experience and helping one another to question their experience and their context to see how things can move forward. Inclusive education incorporates a political dialogue. This chase for standards cannot be challenged before the principles of emancipation, respect, and tolerance are primed. We live in a society that is producing different interpretations to gestures and words, relational dynamics and social roles, making human behavior as a subjective reality informed content. We need to read what students are telling us, even though the complex symbols that constitute the reality. Parents, rightly so, are expressing serious concern on the effectiveness of the current inclusion provisions and the program design. There are also parents who are being left with a bittersweet taste when their children finish secondary school. These young people may not be finding post-secondary alternatives or else adequate skills training schemes that complement their social, psychological, and economic aspirations. This places a lot of pressure on the parents that see schooling within a transition framework and not as an end in itself. Society has a responsibility. And I conclude by what Jenny Morris said in 2002, until we get it right, parents and children will continue to make compromises even though the consequent segregation is a high price to pay. We must respect these choices while at the same time striving to make them unnecessary.
Good evening, folks. Thank you very, very much for the invitation, Andrew, to speak with you this afternoon. And I feel very, very privileged in a number of ways to have heard my colleagues introduce their paper and give that to you, and then to listen to Andrew. I feel incredibly redundant. At this point in time, that they were rehearsing issues about inclusive education being essentially a political struggle. Education is a political struggle. It's about the allocation of privilege and the allocation of failure. It's about inclusion. It's about exclusion. It's political activity. So they so eloquently put to us the challenge of how do we want this to play out in the future. Who do we want to be in? Who do we want to be out? Do we want people out? And if that's the case, how do we go about justifications around this? It's a very complex set of issues. I also feel really privileged. I was so fortunate yesterday to be invited to come to Malta to speak to Andrew's report on research that he's done in on career guidance, and that report struck me very much as a reportage of activism. That this was about using our educational resources to take stock of situations as they are, and to make a series of recommendations about how we improve the world that we live in, which again I see as our basic educational task. So it was a privilege to be invited to be part of that. It was also such a privilege to be asked to come to Malta. And I had a lovely experience yesterday where I look at the program. I was a teacher in Melbourne, Australia, so the game's up. English is my second language too. And in Melbourne, all of the names that were on the program yesterday, like Borg, Muscat, Spiteri, Galea, Azapardi, these are all names of the kids in my classroom. That my classroom in Melbourne was the population was predominantly Greek, Maltese, Italian, and then the miscellaneous debris of those who described themselves as Australian, but they didn't look Aboriginal to me, and so it goes. So for me to be able to come to Malta, it's just been a real privilege, and I thank people for it. I've spoken too long in the thank you part, but I really do feel it, and it's part of my general education. Going to the cathedral this morning and finding that Caravaggio didn't play for AC Milan, but it was part of that too. What I thought I'd do today is, rather than public lecture you, I'm going to do some editing and try to make sure that we have some time to engage in discussion together. But I want to try to tease out an argument, and we'll see how we go. But I thought what I'd do, because I on the way over I got a newspaper to take on the plane and had a particular article that caused me some amusement, and I'll describe it to you in a moment. But I thought I'd start off a little differently. When I talk about inclusion, I want to. I had a horrible feeling that they weren't coming out. That I'll start with Edward Said, for people who've read his work. He wrote an essay in a group of cultural reflections called Reflections on Exile, beautiful collection of work. And in it there's an essay called Travelling Theory Revisited. And in that essay he talks about the way in which when a theory is exported from time and place and put somewhere else, we lose something. And he uses as his example the work of Lukács on reification, which was a powerful and revolutionary assessment of historical conditions. But he argued that once Raymond Williams in Cambridge and Lucien Goldman in Paris got hold of this and popularised it and built new orthodoxies around it, they had, and this is, I could never, be this eloquent, he talks about how they had tamed and domesticated it, and that it lost its insurrectionary power, and that basically that theories that start off in a context of struggle, in a context of critique, can become something quite different when talked of elsewhere. And I guess I called it inclusive education at the crossroads because that's my worry, that people will use the language of inclusive education and the terminology inclusive education to describe all manner of different things and still assert that this is inclusive education. And people, for example, the Association of Special School Principals in Queensland describe themselves as inclusive educationists in the same way that the parents for people with a disability in Queensland describe themselves as seeking inclusive education and arguing against principals. So my worry is that perhaps we've lost our stipulative framework. Perhaps we've, that the word means everything and anything. And in its popularity in policy especially, I think we have to keep going back and asking ourselves questions about, how inclusive for whom, and so it goes. So I think this was the observation of my colleagues, that in a lot of jurisdictions, that there will be the inclusive education policy, but there will be a whole lot going on across the jurisdiction in other areas that make the notion of inclusion quite redundant and militate against everything that's been done over there. And that's what I want to talk about. So to kind of situate myself in all of this, I kind of draw on a number of strands, but I'll just go with a couple of them. Alain Touraine wrote a book, I think it was 2000. I'm pretty sure it was around 2000. Called Can We Live Together? Diversity and Difference, the Politics of Diversity and Difference. And it's a really interesting text because at the end of the day, to answer that question about whether we can live together or whether you have the cosmopolitanisation of particular groups of people, what he was saying is that education provides potential for answering the question. And he then, interestingly enough, establishes, it's a while since I've read this, so I'd love to go back to the detail just to see whether I'm embellishing in my memory of this. But he argues for a democratic education. And it reminded me of Basil at the bottom, Basil Bernstein, in his 1996 book, where he announces, and that's Professor Bernstein. He says, "I will not enter into argument about the need for democratic education. I will announce the preconditions for a democratic education." And one of the preconditions that he lists is inclusivity. But it's very interesting when he talks about it. He says, "By inclusivity, I do not mean absorption." And he links it to another of the preconditions, which is reciprocity. And I think it's an important thing. So if I were to try to make a headline out of this, I would say something to the effect that education ought to be, and schooling ought to be, an apprenticeship in democracy. And that rather than the goal being inclusive education is one of the preconditions for the achievement of that democracy. So it's something that we learn along the way. Now, back to the newspaper. I thought, and I only made this decision just before coming here this afternoon, I thought I might get a touch biographical because I thought late in the evening people will be flagging. I'm likely to fall asleep when I talk. Let alone you. So try to make it half interesting. As a young person growing up in Australia, when we finished our Form 6 Year 12 schooling, a lot of people tended to take a year off, and they would head off to find themselves. And a lot of my colleagues, I didn't do that. I didn't travel away. I just worked in the building industry for a year. But a lot of my friends went over to India to find themselves, and many of them disappeared there in a cloud of smoke. If you get the drift. So I didn't really get that opportunity. But a couple of years ago, I was invited to a conference in New Delhi, and I thought, fantastic, I'll go and find myself. And in the meantime, I'd read expansively and thought of India as a place where one goes on that spiritual journey and receives some form of enlightenment. So that's what I set off to do, to find myself. And arriving there, I did find myself, and I've never been so disappointed in my life, because it wasn't me I was looking for. But what happened was that when we were travelling around the back streets of of old Delhi, passing the Red Fort, the Jain Palace, I did come across some kind of what I thought was a spiritual juxtaposition of two ideas that a life of education and schooling had never delivered to me before. And it was in a back street of old Delhi where this spiritual enlightenment happened. I came across this place called the Happy School. Never had I put those two terms together before. Never had I thought they were possible. But it didn't end there. It got more. It got more wonderful. The notion of a happy teachers training centre. So I'm not playing around with Photoshop or anything like that. That's the building. You can find it yourselves. There's a happy school. Somewhere in this world, there is a happy school and there is a place to train happy teachers. And I took it back to my faculty saying, I think we might have something here. And at one level, I can be really flippant about it and glib. But at another level, the notion of happiness and education might be explored a little further. And this is my comment about the newspaper. In The Independent the other day, I grab it. Inside, not very far inside, there's a headline saying, "Children unhappy at school, researchers' discovery." And I'm thinking, my gosh, we ought to have discovered this a little earlier. This is no new. I wanted to take the newspaper back and get my money back because it wasn't news, for goodness sake. So the notion of schooling is that it's happy for some. And this takes me to my colleague's comments earlier, and I'll simply be echoing it. But where I went to school in Australia, it certainly wasn't happy for everyone. Aboriginal children, if you want the most reliable predictors of educational failure in Australia, Aboriginality, poverty, disability. Okay? So in terms of thinking about a reformation of education and struggling over the uneven distribution of privilege, you really don't have to be Einstein. You don't need to chase down too far. So that this thing that we call school was never meant for everybody. But you know, it's always been about the allocation of failure. But it used to be that that wasn't a problem. Because formerly, schools were able to hide their failure to educate all. The collusion with the unskilled labour market meant that young people who failed school had somewhere to go. that they were on the farm, the factory, shop, domestic work, and so it went. Changes in the nature and structure of the labour market have meant that these people are either on the street or they're in school. And schools have to live with that failure. And I want to talk about how they do that. Similarly, we took Aboriginal children, not only from their families, but their education went on somewhere else, in the missions and the reserves. And while I was a deputy director of an education department in Australia, I knew that when we were doing our national testing, statewide testing for the national tests for the allocation of funding, there were schools that would ask Aboriginal children and other children to that they knew weren't going to do well in the tests to stay away because it was about the funding. Anyway, sorry, I'm... So somebody like Ken Polk, a criminologist in Australia, says, for too many, the experience of schooling is a daily experience of humiliation and pain. So where I'd make the linkage is in that statement earlier that should we continue to talk about this thing that we call the regular and the special school? The regular and the special school, it's not as if the special school is something that we demonise as problematic here. It's the relationship of the two that is deeply problematic. And it's not as if regular schools are schools that well serve all students. They're not doing the job that they were established for. And here, please, I'm not attacking teachers. You know, this is the context they find themselves in. This was an invention of some years ago, but we've tried to shore it up, and that's the bit I'll come to. So for me, inclusive education, you know, one level is elegantly simple. Who's in, who's out, how come, and what do we want to do about it? It's as simple and as complex as that, because when we come to the how come, it demands that we start to look at education policy writ large and the minutiae of activity, and I'll try to get to that. It's interesting, a few of us were talking earlier. The UK have invested very, very heavily in in the issue of truancy. You know, for many kids are voting about school with their feet, and it was brought to my attention that in Malta, you know, the issue of absenteeism is quite significant. The issue of presence would be super significant as well. What then would we do with that? And this is what I want to move to. In terms of trying to say what I think inclusion is and isn't, I just put a couple of bullet points. It's not about assimilation, making people the same. It's about, you know, the representation of difference and diversity, and that has all kinds of implications for how we construct a curriculum and how we go about pedagogy. Inclusive education is about cultural politics. Therefore, our role as inclusive educationists becomes that of a cultural vigilante almost, and it's about all students. But I want to look at one particular group, and that's around disability. Now, don't take all of this down. You can find it in Sally Tomlinson's book. This is just her representation of the statutory, this is harder than conundrum, the statutory categories of handicap, as they were described between 1886 and 1981. So we start with idiots and imbeciles, and we end up with quite a long list. If I were to model good pedagogy and throw this open, what would you tell me? What What strikes you about the chart? Let me help a little. That the categories are expanding. Now, one take on that, as we move away from idiots and imbeciles and start to augment with the blind, the deaf, the epileptic, the defective. Defective is interesting as the notion of moral imbecile. How do we define and diagnose moral imbecile? Is there a moral imbecile in the help, you know, with this process? And so we see a real expansion. Now, there are some peak periods of activity. And you know, the establishment of the, you know, counselling and guidance, the school psychologist service, might be an interesting watershed in the history of the allocation of labels. One take on this might be that our knowledge is getting more and more sophisticated, more and more useful, and so it goes. Another argument, and if I were to take this chart further, and to go to DSM-4 and put in some of the, you know, the more recent categories of diagnosis, I might be able to say, well, the, you know, it's expanding like this. You know, would I be unwarranted in trying to rehearse a political kind of economy around this, and to say that as the labour market has changed structure and people who weren't meant to be in school are in school, we're not changing the role, the nature, the activity of school as much as we are enlisting special educational needs as a process of governmentality or governance and control and containment. Just a thought. I'll depict it another way, and I'll try and use some real-world examples of policy being played out. I wanted to describe the approach that we've taken as being rather flat-earthed, as being very, very linear. When people think about equity in terms of disabled students, and I use the term disabled students rather than students with a disability because I'm using disabled as a verb, okay? When we look at that, the way in which it's tended to work or play out within the civil service, bureaucracies, education jurisdictions, is that in order to achieve equity for these students, we need to firstly work out the level of disability that the student has, do some kind of actuarial gymnastics to work out what that means in terms of additional resources, AR, and if you put the two together, you will then somehow have delivered equity and inclusive education. And I'm not sure that it has played out this way. Let me take it a bit further. I'll go back to that. In 1984, the Ministry of Education in Victoria delivered what was quite radical policy at that time called Integration in Victorian Education. And it was governed by five guiding principles. And amongst those principles was all students have a right to be enrolled in their neighbourhood school. And I'm smiling, and I'll explain why. All children can learn and be taught. Decisions about the placement of students will be achieved collaboratively. The education of students, will be achieved collaboratively between parents, students and teachers. And so it went on. And resources ought to be school-based. So, very interesting. As more and more children were being identified as disabled, the teachers' unions became very restive about the implications of this and what the character of classrooms would look like, and pressured government so that government then wrote in a caveat that said all children have a right to be enrolled in their neighbourhood school, but their admission will be delayed until the school has the resources to enable them to receive an education. Now, you can see that at one level that seems perfectly viable. But the problem is the notion of, well, what constitutes the resources that they ought to have? And what happened was that schools were delaying and parents were getting frustrated and then trying to find the school that would take their child, and it became a very, very acrimonious set of discussions. Michael Lunig, I think, captures the notion that when policymakers have an idea in their head, it makes perfect sense and you can see it. But in the actual playing out of things, if the policy, and I see policy as something that's made at all levels, and I'll describe that later, if the policy theorising in the first instance and taking care of business with regard to implementation doesn't go on, you come out at the end of it with altogether different things than you anticipated. I want to give you an example. This has gone out of alignment, I'm sorry. So, at the time of the release of that policy in 1984, you have about 4,900 kids in segregated special schooling. And then also in 1984, there are no kids who are considered in inclusive education children, as they came to be known, which was really fascinating too. The notion was that children would go to the mainstream, that resources would follow them. Cullen and Brown did an audit of the program in 1993, and there were 5,100 children in segregated special schooling and 5,000 integration or inclusion children. You can see that. What's going on? What was interesting is that it was at a time when the, and this was echoed in Ontario, it was actually a time where enrolments declined. The overall student population of the state was going. Inclusive education funding was allocated to children who were having, who had disabilities, impairments, or problems in schooling. Problems in schooling became the, so emotional social problems became, and the emotionally socially disturbed became the key category of child that was targeted here. In Ontario, I've just highlighted, between 2003, special education funding increased in that jurisdiction between 2003-2004 by 1%. You go to the following year, it's 6.8%. So you have this kind of this influx of funding, or, you know, You have this expansion of funding for inclusive education and for students with disability, and you have Treasury. Like, you know, when I was in Queensland Department, Treasury was going, you know, were jumping out of their tree at me and saying, you know, we're spending more in education on students with disabilities than the portfolio for people with disabilities was spending on whole of life support. What's this about? And at the end of the day, the question was, did this make for a more inclusive education? One of the schools, when I was looking at the data, and I told people yesterday, one of the schools just down the coast had more children with speech-language impairment than any other school in the state of Queensland. So I went to the school to try and find out what exactly that meant. And what the teachers and speech therapists were describing to me was deprivation and delay. That you had kids in a very deprived area who weren't, you know, reading ready, and who weren't skilled in their communication as their peers, because of, you know, problems that one could link more to poverty and the pathology of poverty than one could link perhaps to the individual pathology of the child. So for me, these kinds of issues are really very, very significant. And in work by Linda Graham in the New South Wales jurisdiction, you see that special education provision has stayed pretty much, no, I don't have it here, has stayed pretty flatline, as has special classrooms in regular schools, again, fairly flatline. But the diagnosis of children with emotional and behavioural difficulties is going through the roof. Now, if you put that back with that data of who's staying at school and how are we dealing with this, other kinds of questions start to emerge. And if you ask the question from a very hard-nosed point of view at the end of the day, from the point of view of somebody funding education, is this making for a more inclusive experience for students? The answer is probably no, because a lot of the resource is going into the provision of inclusion aids. And the way in which I've observed inclusion aids being used in a lot of jurisdictions is that it's a minder. It's somebody who sits with a child to minimise the potential for disruption. And they explain, they interpret what the teacher has said. So another way of looking at that might be to ask the question, are we developing a system whereby we have one set of kids who get their education from a teacher and another, the residualised education of children with assistance? At the same time as this is going on, if you look at education policy writ large, because the disconnection of different forms, elements of policy raft, you know, show that referral to pupil referral units, that is, you know, behaviour units outside the school system, is continuing to grow. So we're funding inclusive education, but we're excluding at greater rates. Segregated education in Ontario is growing. It's the most segregated provision in kind of the North American continent. So, you know, there are a lot of issues within all of this. It demands that we ask questions not just of the pathology of this species we want to call the defective or disabled child. It makes us want to ask questions about schools. And what I'll finish up with is a look at a project that was going on in Queensland at the time that I was minister. That Bob Lingard, Alan Luke, Jim Ladwig, a few other people were involved in what was called QSRLS, the Queensland School Reform Longitudinal Study. And in Australian terms, it was a big research project. There was 1.6 million or something given by the state government to this particular project. And it was a Conservative government that gave that money, which is really interesting. And basically what they wanted to find out was whether there was a link between improved student outcomes and school-based leadership. School-based management. And they came to the conclusion very quickly that there wasn't really a hypodermic linkage, you know, that it could create the conditions whereby there were improved outcomes, but equally it could provide all kinds of distractions where principals were going to conferences led by management gurus talking about how best to arrange their philofax. But not providing educational leadership, which is part of the job description. So what they decided was that they'd try to work out what we would be looking for improved educational outcomes, for students, improved student outcomes, and then backward map to what conditions would create that. So it was a very large study, 24 schools involved, there were 975 lessons mapped, and so it went. And they used the work of Fred Newman's and his associates on authentic pedagogy and authentic achievement to kind of backward map to look at the what was going on in terms of teaching in classrooms. And the notion was that authentic student achievement was contingent on the type of teaching, what kind of teaching would produce that. So the next set of questions were what kinds of school organisation produced the classrooms that enabled that kind of teaching, what kind of external support. So it was that kind of process. They observed the classrooms looking for kind of four areas of work in the teaching. Intellectual quality, how demanding it was, and you'll see deep understanding, deep knowledge, and so it goes. I won't read all of the slide to you. There's nothing worse than academic karaoke where people read what you've already finished reading. Connectedness, the notion of is it relevant? Is the teaching relevant and speak to the lives of students? Do they draw from them? Are students connected to what they're doing? Supportive classroom environment and the recognition and valuing of difference, the diversity scale. The diversity scale in the whole of the study was the weakest part of it, but that's another story. Now, at the end of the day, there's a five-point tier, and in this representation of it, it hasn't come out clearly enough, but I'll try and describe elements of it. That the recognition of difference is the green line at the bottom. It was a five-point scale, and you'll see that the achievements, 1, 2, 3, are in, you know, from mid-3 at its highest point downwards. And the highest area of achievement was the red line in terms of evidence of work in the teaching was a supportive school environment. And one of the respondents to the research said, well, if all we're doing is providing supportive classrooms and you know, supportive institutions, why don't we work in hospitals? There's the other bit, the education bit. In terms of the intellectual demand, that's the dark blue line, second from bottom. And what they provided some really interesting evidence of was the fact that teachers tended to be able to project high demand in terms of expectation, but when it came to developing assessment tools to demonstrate particular knowledge, skills and disposition, they didn't have that repertoire of skills. So that there was a dumbing down process in the assessment. And they found that apart from early on in the career, where there was a year 2 diagnostic test, and then later where there was a two-year internal assessment moderation system in year 11 and 12, teachers tended to be assessment illiterate. You know, that's in the report. And it's there on the web. Go to it. It's a fascinating study. In terms of the recognition of diversity and difference, what they were saying was that teachers can have sustained conversations of great quality about diversity and difference and the value therein, or thereof, but when it came to finding evidence of that being played out in their teaching, there was little evidence of it in the classrooms that they observed. And so it went. Connection, the yellow line, and so on. Now, there's something else that really is very striking about this set of data. It's another chance for riotous participation. They refer to this as a year 9 dip. the middle years of schooling. And we know that the literature and work around the middle years of schooling, you know, how important and that has been in terms of thinking about reform of secondary schooling. And it seemed that there was palpable evidence produced through the data that there was a problem with respect to what went on in those years of schooling. So that when schooling got back to the serious end, there was a lift in the game. So, where does this leave us? It leaves us with a question about the nature and activity of schools that we describe as regular. There are questions that I glossed over before in relation to what happens to children who have an segregated education in terms of their work destinations, and there's some very compelling data about the difference between kids with disabilities educated in special and regular schools. Regular school kids end up in work more, it's far more likely than those kids in segregated provision. So there are real issues about the nature of those two forms of schooling. And the place that my colleagues were at was asking a question about, well, if we want to pursue this thing we call inclusive education, it's not just about the diagnosis and the picking of defects. It's not a limp and twitch hunt. It's something about the reconstruction of schooling to ensure that it does what it's supposed to be doing for all kids. Because we know that it's not simply disabled children that are struggling with this. It's far more than that. Thank you.
You have just listened to a talk organized by the Department of Youth and Community Studies entitled Inclusive Education at the Crossroads. This talk was delivered by Professor Roger Slee from the University of London and chaired by Dr. Andrew Atsopardi.
Ħitan u swar, id-difiża tal-Gżejjer Maltin matul is-sekli. Kitba u preżentazzjoni Vincent Zammit. Il-bniedem dejjem ra kif għamel u dawwar lilu nnifsu b'kumditajiet. Dawn seta' kienu fl-ambjent kif jgħix, inkella fl-oġġetti ta' madwaru. Iżda ximdaqiet l-istess kumditajiet kienu sejrin jiġbdu lejra ta' ħaddieħor. Dan minħabba li l-kumditajiet materjali setgħu jkunu mżejna u anki superati minn kumditajiet naturali. Il-Gżejjer Maltin ma tantx għandhom rikettzi naturali ħlief għal diversi bajjiet u portijiet naturali flimkien mal-pożizzjoni strateġika tal-istess Gżejjer. Minħabba f'hekk naraw li matul iż-żmien kien inħass il-bżonn li jibnu bini biex jiddefendu dawk il-kumditajiet li kellhom. Fost il-kumditajiet kien hemm il-ħajja, ir-reliġjon, kif ukoll il-libertà. Il-bini ta' ħitan u swar mhuwiex xi ħaġa li bdiet isseħħ minn meta ġew il-kavalieri f'Malta. L-evidenza ta' swar tmur ħafna lura, tmur lura fil-fatt tal-madwar 4,000 sena ilu. Naturalment, il-ħajja ta' dak iż-żmien kienet ferm differenti. Dan kien il-perjodu magħruf bħala żmien il-preistorja. Dan ifisser li dokumenti ma kienx hemm, u għalhekk aħna hemm bżonn li nibnu l-istorja tagħna fuq il-fdalijiet u studji oħra. Tadaniz min imbat wieħed jista' jqabbel l-istess ftit fdalijiet li għandna f'Malta ma' dawk ta' barra xtutna. Għalkemm semmejt il-perjodu preistoriku, miex qiegħed ngħid li dawn is-swar imorru lura l-istess żmien tat-tempji ta' ħaġar qiem ġgantija u l-oħrajn. Dak il-perjodu huwa maħsub li kien relattivament kwiet u nieqes minn inkwiet kbir bejn il-komunitajiet. Iżda lejn is-sena 2000 qabel Kristu, il-Mediterran ma baqax l-istess. Kien hemm ħafna ċaqliq ta' villaġġi u komunitajiet sħaħ li kienu jgħixu matul il-kosta. Kollox indika li barra dan iċ-ċaqliq kien hemm ukoll is-sejba ta' kif il-bniedem seta' jħallat materjal flimkien u joħloq il-bronz. U dan kollu beda jgħin ħalli jiżdied il-ġliet biex ikun hemm dan il-kontroll fuq dan il-materjal qed prezzjuż. Il-gżej Maltin sabu ruħum jiffurmaw parti minn din id-dinja. Mhux għax kien hemm il-biża' li xi ħadd jiġi ħalli jieħu xi riżorsi naturali, iżda l-attakki żdiedu. Dan ma jfissirx li kien hawn ħafna attakki fuq Malta għax m'hemm xejn x'indika dan. Li nafu huwa li l-mentalità tan-nies li kienu jqogħdu f'Malta ħasbu għal possibilità li jkunu attakkati. Jista' jkun li l-istess villaġġi jew komunitajiet differenti li kien hemm f'Malta kienu edewwa ta' xulxin. X'nistgħu nsemmu dwar dawn in-nies li jgħixu f'Malta u li juri li kienu mbeżżajn minn xi attakk? Qatt fadal ftit f'dalijiet li jagħtuna stampa kemm xejn imċempra ta' dak iż-żmien. Fil-waqt li ta' żmien it-tempi ftit li xejn nafu dwar il-villaġġi tal-Maltin, ta' żmien tal-bronż l-informazzjoni hija ftit aħjar. Instabu diversi postijiet madwar il-gżejjer Maltin. U għalkemm mhux kollha huma tal-istess daqs u kalibru, kważi kollha għandhom karatteristika partikolari. Din kienet il-lokalità ta' fejn inbnew il-villaġġi. Il-postijiet kienu magħżula sew. Kien hemm konsiderazzjonijiet differenti minn sempliċiment art fertili fil-viċin għax jidher li ta' żmien kien jikkredi mod ieħor. Minħabba f'hekk wieħed jinnota li l-postijiet ġew stabbiliti minħabba l-bżonnijiet ta' difiża. Il-lokalitajiet li nsibu fil-gżejjer Maltin huma fl-istess ħin spettakolari. Dan minħabba l-fatt li dawn jinstabu fuq postijiet għoljin u mdawrin b'widien fertili. Iħsieb kien li l-ebda għadu ma jkun jista' jattakka l-post b'sorpriża. Dawn in-nies ta' żmien il-bronż probabbilment kienu baħħara tajbin huma wkoll. U dan nafuh mill-istess idejat u stili ta' bini u difiża. Kif ukoll tal-fuħħar misjub f'Malta. L-istil ta' bini tal-villaġġi huwa komuni madwar il-Mediterran kollu. Mhux hekk biss, iżda f'ċertu postijiet fl-Italja dawn it-tip ta' diviża kienu baqgħu jintużaw anki mal-bidu tal-ħakma Rumana. Iżda mistoqsija li forsi wieħed jagħmel dwar dawn il-postijiet f'Malta hija fejn jinstabu dawn il-postijiet. Insemmu Borċinadur fil-limiti ta' Birżabbuġa, il-Wardija ta' San Giorgio limiti ta' Siġġiewi, il-Baħrija limiti ta' Rabat, il-Qortin limiti ta' San Pawl il-Baħar u l-Karraba limiti ta' l-Imġar. F'Għawdex nafu żgur post wieħed in-Nuffara limiti ta' Xara. Jista' jkun li kien hemm diversi aktar lokalitajiet li kienu jintużaw min-nies ta' żmien il-bronż, iżda l-evidenza hija nieqsa. L-aktar karatteristika komuni ta' dawn il-postijiet hija li jinstabu fuq l-għoljiet, imdawrin birdumijiet. In-Nuffara hija mdawra birdumijiet madwar l-għolja kollha. Minħabba f'hekk ma kienx hemm il-bżonn li jkun hemm mibnija ħitan. Iżda f'postijiet oħra, il-bżonn ta' bini ta' ħitan difensivi inħass bżonn jus. F'Borċinadur u fil-Wardija ta' San Giorgio il-ħitan inbnew u għatfadal f'dalijiet tagħhom ukoll. L-aktar wieħed impressjonanti huwa Borċinadur. Dawn il-fdalijiet jinstabu fuq olja bejn żewġ widien. Fuq wara l-olja tibda niżla l-isfel lejn il-bajja li f'dawk iż-żminijiet nafu li kienet aktar il-barra milli qiegħda llum.
Waqt skavi li saru minn Dr. Trump kienu nstabu f'dalijiet ta' kmamar li taw indikazzjoni ta' tip ta' kmamar f'dan il-villaġġ. Fuq qudiem, ġifieri, f'dik il-parti fejn hemm il-wesa li tħares għal fuq il-pjanura, hemm sistema ta' ħajt mibni b'mod u maniera li juri li l-ħsieb kien ta' wieħed defensiv. Il-ġebel użat huwa mdaqqas, mhuwiex irfinut. Hemm diversi ġebel iża li jintużaw biex iddaħlu bħala feles ħalli jżommu l-ħajt f'postu. Dan il-ħajt għandu għoli ta' madwar 4 metri, l-ħxuna hija konsiderevoli wkoll. Il-ħajt jaqsam il-pjanura kollha u għandu bħal daħla żgħira f'ġenb minnu. Meta wieħed ikun quddiem dawn il-ħajt ta' Burġ Nadur, mill-ewwel jifhem bil-ħsieb ta' dawk li bnewh. L-attakk kien maħsub li seta' jiġi biss minn fuq l-art u minnaħa waħda biss. Minħabba fejn il-ħajt imbena fejn imbena biex ikun żgur ta' difiża. Barra minn hekk dawn in-nies żammew il-bajja taħt għajnejhom ukoll, probabbilment minħabba l-kummerċ u l-kuntatti li kellhom mas'qallija. Kumment ieħor li wieħed dejjem irid jagħti dwar dawn il-villaġġi ta' żmien tal-bronż huwa l-fatt li d-dawra li hija offruta diviża tkun żgħira. Dan jista' jkun minħabba l-fatt li l-parti diviża kienet bħala iċ-ċittadella. In-nies kellhom id-djar u l-irzieset tagħhom imxerdin fil-viċinanzi. Jekk jinqala l-każ ta' xi attakk, allura jirtiraw kollha kemm huma wara swar. Għalkemm ta' żmien il-bronż kien inħass il-bżonn li jkun hemm xi mod ta' diviża, evidenzi ta' attakki ma nstabux. Jista' jkun li swar inbnew minħabba biża li setgħu jiġu attakkati. Jista' jkun ukoll li l-istess nies li ġew jgħixu fuq il-gżejjer Maltin kellhom dik l-esperjenza diġà fil-postijiet fejn kienu qabel. Iżda meta madwar is-sena 700 qabel Kristu bdew jiefqu fuq gżiritna l-Feniċi jidher li ma kienx hemm attakki militari. Huwa magħruf li l-Feniċi kienu negozjanti u aktar kellhom moħħhom fin-negozju u portijiet tajba milli konkwisti militari. Dan ma jfissirx li ma ħasbux biex jiddefendu l-pożizzjonijiet tagħhom. Fuq kollox iż-żmien kien jitlob li wieħed jaħseb fid-diviża. Barra minn hekk wieħed mir-raġunijiet ta' attakk militari huwa l-bżonn ta' kontroll ta' portijiet u kummerċ. Il-Feniċi f'Malta kellhom dawn l-istess vantaġġi. Mill-fdalijiet li nstabu huwa maħsub li l-Feniċi ħasbu ħalli jkollhom imħażen fl-inħawi tal-portijiet, tempji lill-allatt tagħhom kif ukoll bini ieħor fiċ-ċentru ta' Malta. Dan dal-aħħar huwa l-istess lokalità fejn dejjem baqa' jkun hemm okkupazzjoni umana. U ma' żmien il-belt tal-imdina ġiet imwaqfa. Min jaf il-għalan tażel dan il-post biex ikun hemm bħal belt żgħira imdawra biswar. Jista' jkun li hawnhekk diġà kien hemm villaġġ ta' żmien tal-bronż. U bħajt jiddefendi parti mill-istess villaġġ. Jekk ikun hekk, mhux ħaġa diffiċli biex timmaġina li l-Feniċi sempliċiment komplew itejbu dak li tiġa kien hemm. Għalkemm swar ta' żmien il-Feniċi fl-imdina jew fl-inħawi huma ftit u mhux daqshekk ċerti li jappartjenu li dan il-poplu, hemm evidenza oħra li tgħinna nemmnu li hawnhekk kien hawn konċentrazzjoni ta' nies jgħixu fl-inħawi. Dawn huma l-oqbra li jinstabu f'numru konsiderevoli imxerdin madwar ir-Rabat u l-imdina. Il-preżenza ta' oqbra Feniċi huwa prova biżejjed li hawnhekk kien hawn komunità. Għalkemm provi ta' swar mhumiex konkreti, wieħed irid jifhem li l-Feniċi kellhom diversi jadewa, u fosthom kien hemm il-Griegi. Dawn tal-aħħar kellhom diversi bliet kolonji fis-qallija, u għalhekk il-biża ta' xi attakk qatt ma kien il-bogħod. Bħalma kienu għamlu f'Malta, huwa maħsub li l-Feniċi għamlu l-istess f'Għawdex. Iċ-ċittadella huwa maħsub kien il-post fejn f'Għawdex kien hemm iċ-ċentru ewlieni, u li probabbilment imdawwar biswar. L-istess, bħalma semmejt dwar l-imdina, ftit huma l-fdalijiet li nstabu biex joffrunna aktar dettalji. Barra minn hekk mistoqsija oħra hija wkoll dwar il-possibilità li kien hemm aktar postijiet fejn setgħu jgħixu n-nies. Indikazzjonijiet hemm mhux ħażin u dawn huma l-preżenza ta' ħafna oqbra. Kull fejn wieħed se jsib numru ta' oqbra huwa sinjal li kien hemm in-nies jgħixu fl-inħawi. Iżda l-isfortuna hija li aktar minn hekk ma tfadal xejn. Iżgħej Maltin kellhom ikunu fil-mira tal-espansjoni Rumana u dan kienna naraw fl-attakki li saru fuq żirtna. Barra minn hekk din kellha twassal ukoll għall-ħakma permanenti tar-Rumani fuq Malta. Għadkom kif smajtu, ħitanu swar. Id-difiża tal-żejjer Maltin matul is-sekli. Kitba u preżentazzjoni Vincent Zamit.